Come close. Run your fingers over the stones of this ancient city, these temples of worship and places of business, and picture them falling into desolation, just drifting sand and standing walls and vacant buildings. You can't take it with you where you're going, but someone who comes here in 5,000 years exploring might unearth a recording that tells the world your story. Some confabulation of words stored in a subterranean purgatory could well emerge to tell those who still dwell on Earth that you were born and that your works were worth reporting. Well, this is the first story, not the oldest told by troubadours, but the oldest in written form. Because who can say whether troubadours don't improve their sources? Of course, the origins of this story are oral, but it was preserved for thousands of years in Akkadian verse tablets and Sumerian cuneiform, preserved like Cuban cigars in a humidor, so we can be sure that it's true to its source. Not a folk story transformed in 10,000 villages, but a relic of the ancient world, preserved with diligence, the oldest narrative that still exists, the Epic of Gilgamesh. When the gods created Gilgamesh, they gave him a perfect body, like Arnie when his films were still impressive, like Conan the Barbarian, physical brilliance, like sculpted steel as flesh. The gods endowed him with strength and courage and fine features. In terms of appearance, he was the first in line. Brad Pitt would have looked like a turd beside him. He was one-third mortal and two-thirds divine. And as an aside, I guess the Sumerians, when this poem was written, were not aware of chromosome division or Mendelian genetics. No organism that reproduces sexually is two-thirds of anything. Maybe they calculated paternity as a percentage of the number of men that the mother had been with before she got pregnant, which is the case with certain indigenous South American Indians, increasing the incentive for the men to collaborate on parental investment. But when the gods are involved, those calculations are irrelevant, because they're practically omnipotent, and Gilgamesh was a mortal man with two-thirds god genes. In the Sumerian catalog of kings, he's listed as the fifth ruler of Uruk after the flood came and washed away all things. So our story begins with Gilgamesh in charge of the peace, and the people of Uruk not pleased. And why were they less than pleased? Because Gilgamesh was an extreme sex fiend. To put it simply, he deflowered every virgin and slept with the wife of every peasant and the daughter of every nobleman whenever he felt the urge. And for the people of Uruk, this was a heavy burden. In fact, the original version only says that the men found it a heavy burden, which begs the question, was the consent of these women earned, or did he just take it? My inclination is to stay with the basics. Nowhere is he referred to as Gilgamesh the Rapist, which means he had game and the men were jealous haters. But don't these questions always plague men of status? Was he Bill Clinton-esque or Tiger Woods with the waitress, or was he Roman Polanski or Mike Tyson dangerous? I can't possibly say from these ancient pages, but I'd prefer to work with a sympathetic protagonist. So in my version, he gets the benefit of the doubt. Gilgamesh impressed the women with his physical prowess, but his sexual endowments were hateful to his people, so they huddled in their houses and prayed for relief to the gods, like, please, make him an equal. And the gods heard their pleas and created Enkidu. Enkidu was a wild man, Tarzan of the highlands. His body was covered in hair and fine mats. He knew nothing of civilization and finance, a feral child. He ran with the ibex and ate nothing but plants. Plus, he was massive. He had this habit of releasing animals from traps and snares whenever they got captured. And eventually, one of the trappers ran back to the city to ask Gilgamesh for some answers. He said, there is this massive hairy man who keeps smashing the traps that we set in mountain pastures. He's either half animal or he's an animal rights activist, but either way, I'm at my wit's end. Any suggestions? And Gilgamesh said, here's what you do. You go to Ishtar's temple and you get a prostitute. Now, Ishtar was the goddess of love and destruction too, and a priestess has offered free sex to the multitude. Maybe religion is something even Christopher Hitchens could have gotten into if that's what it offered you. So Gilgamesh said, yeah, you get this temple hoe, this child of pleasure, and you get her to go with you down to the watering hole, and you get her to take off her clothes. And this wild man, well, he won't be wild no more. Forgive the ebonic inflections, but I just always wanted to use the word hoe in an epic. Anyway, it happened exactly as Gilgamesh predicted. Enkidu came down to the lake to take a drink, and he saw this beautiful, soft, naked being, this succulent, supple lady, and she embraced him, and shwing! For 6 days and 7 nights, they lay by the lakeside insatiably shagging, and it was his first time. But after, when he tried to go back to his animal friends, they just looked at him and fled. innocence lost. Enkidu's intimate frolics with the temple harlot had cost him his connection with nature. Never again would his animal friends accept him as one of them. And from that day forward, he was civilized. The prostitute fed him bread and wine and said, "Enkidu, you are wise. Why sleep in the wild when there's shelter nearby?" And she took his hand and she led him like a child to the shepherd's tent and bade him step inside, and she clothed and bathed him. And he stayed with the shepherds for a stretch of time and protected them from lions. Enkidu stayed with the shepherds for a while, but soon word arrived from the city that there was a wedding and Gilgamesh was claiming his birthright, the privilege of first night. That is, the right to be the first to fertilize the bride on her wedding night, just like the English did to the Scottish before 1305 when William Wallace kicked their asses, which served them right. Well, the Sumerian groom was also quite perturbed by this incursion into his personal life, and when Kidu heard about this, he turned white with anger and traveled to Uruk, determined to fight. The bridal bed was made. A virgin lay within it, a trembling, nervous babe, as Gilgamesh approached the house, determined to get laid. But Enkidu stepped in front of him and blocked his way. Clash of the titans. Their grasps were like vice grips as they grappled and tightened their massive biceps, striving like angry bisons, each man trying to gain the upper hand on his rival. It was a wrestling match that cracked the keystones in the walls of Uruk and shook the ziggurats in the foundations of people's homes. But in the end, Enkidu was thrown. He paid his respects to Gilgamesh for besting him, and Gilgamesh was impressed that someone had even tested him, because every man he'd ever met until then was estrogen, and from then on he treated Enkidu like his next of kin. Now, Gilgamesh was obsessed with legacy building. He wanted his name to be etched on bricks and listed where the names of famous men are written. So they embarked on a campaign of adventurism. They traveled to the Lebanese hills, to the cedar forest, where they cut down trees and defeated the evil demon guardian, the protector of those sweet resources. Now, everyone tried to warn them off this quest. They said, "Don't go, the demon's jaws are death. When he says hum baba, hum baba, hum hum baba, it's like he has napalm for breath." But no one could convince them to stop, because Gilgamesh believed that he was on a mission from God. And when they reached the demon, his defenses were weak. They overpowered him easily, and he fell to his knees, pleading like a refugee, like a fugitive in a spider hole, begging for his life. But they were icy cold. They executed him with three precise blows and turned their eyes towards home. Other adventures awaited. Ishtar tried to seduce Gilgamesh by offering herself to him naked, but he rejected her, and she flew into a jealous rage full of indignation. Determined to take vengeance, she released the Bull of Heaven, a personified drought, which they defeated with a sword strike, somehow. But Gilgamesh was really swelling with pride now, so the gods said, "Time to take this guy down." They took the side route. They knew that Enkidu was his Achilles heel, because he was the key to his feelings. So the gods decreed that Enkidu would soon cease to exist, and he fell into a deep sickness and had a feverish dream vision of life after death, in which he was a feathered wretch sitting in pitch darkness, staring ahead at an endless stretch of time. And he cursed everyone he'd ever met since he left the wilderness. The prostitute, the trapper, everyone except for Gilgamesh, who stood by his side, singing a death lament until Enkidu's final breath was spent. For the rest of this story, Gilgamesh is an emotional wreck, in a state of perpetual mourning, on a desperate quest to try to make his flesh immortal, and it's interesting, but it isn't worth reporting. It's fragmented and repetitive, and it never really finishes, although it does contain a fascinating parallel with Genesis. Suffice to say, immortality eluded him, and he returned to Uruk in a state of disillusionment and lived out his life just like the rest of us do, by having children and making civic improvements. So he didn't live forever, but he did leave descendants, which means his genes probably make up 1/10 of 1/10 of 1% of 100,000 Middle Eastern residents. But this form of immortality is just divisive. And he left us his story, the Epic of Gilgamesh, which he chiseled into the walls of his city while building it. And it tells us that this human obsession with living forever in the face of certain death is something we've always wrestled with, which tells us something about what it is to be human. If immortality exists, then I guess you're listening to it. I guess you're listening to it. I guess you're listening to it.